Welcome to another edition of Book Talk. I'm Blake McVeigh, and I'm happy to welcome Wayne A. Wiegand to the program today. Mr. Wiegand is F. William Summers Professor of Library and Information Studies Emeritus and Professor of American Studies at Florida State University. He has partnered with his wife, Shirley A. Wiegand, to complete the book, The Desegregation of Public Libraries in the Jim Crow South, which is published by Louisiana State University Press. The work tells the story of the integration of Southern public libraries in several cities during the 1950s and 60s, steadfastly utilizing protest, other forms of direct action, and the legal system. Activists were eventually successful in their quest to integrate public libraries in the South. Welcome, Wayne.
Thank you. Thank you for having me, Blake.
As you began your research on this book, did you have any expectations going in? Did you expect to find anything in particular about library integration that might be different from other areas of public life that were integrated?
The seeds of this book came from a previous book that I wrote entitled Part of Our Lives, A People's History of the American Public Library. And because of digitized newspaper databases that have been put up since the late 1990s, a whole bunch of the research that I was doing for that public library's history revealed that there were other stories particular to the integration of segregated public libraries in the South. So as I was finishing up the manuscript for the Part of Our Lives, I pretty early determined that was a story that needed to be told because no one had told it before. My entire professional adult life has been focused on library history, so it was just natural to make one transition to the other. But this particular story also had a great many federal court cases that were filed, and because I don't speak law, and my wife does, she's a legal educator, emeritus professor out of the College of Law at Marquette University in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, I asked her if she would participate with me in co-authoring the book, and she said sure, because she also has interests in civil rights history. So that's how we sort of came together around this topic.
So there was a story that was obviously there.
Yes.
You just wanted to flesh it out and make it known.
Correct.
Was it surprising to you at all that no one had told this story?
Yes. There are several reasons for being surprised. First of all, not many of the high-profile civil rights leaders like Ralph Abernathy, Stokely Carmichael, James Farmer, or Martin Luther King Jr. participated in public library protests. So the national media that followed them around didn't notice that public libraries were also being addressed. The shocking thing for us, shocking is a bad word. The very surprising thing for us was how young these people were who were protesting in public libraries. And they range from age 9 through age 18. So for the most part, the story that we were really glad to tell centers around these kids. They are hidden figures in civil rights history that have been overlooked by Southern historians, by civil rights historians, and certainly by library historians.
So do you think that is why the story had been untold, because it was a bunch of kids?
Yes. A second reason, however, is that libraries are not compulsory institutions like schools are or like the courts are. So generally, public libraries integrated before the local schools did. And community leaders who supported Jim Crow systems often saw the library as, well, let's just go ahead and integrate the library, but not the schools. So it was kind of a, we'll give you this one, but we won't give you the schools.
Okay. So people who might be upset about integration, they could just choose not to go to the library, and it could kind of be swept under the rug.
That's correct.
Is something kind of unspoken there that libraries were some of the first institutions to be integrated, or is that not the case?
I don't feel comfortable saying conclusively yes, but the anecdotal evidence we've uncovered suggests that libraries were some of the first institutions to be integrated in the Deep South. Now, one must always keep in mind the local customs. Let me give you an example. In Danville, Virginia, the public library was located in a building that was called the last capital of the Confederacy. Jefferson Davis held his last cabinet meeting there before the Confederacy fell. So there was a deep attachment by the local establishment to keep that building segregated. And so the resistance was fairly high there. Whereas you go to Bessemer, Alabama, the resistance was hardly felt at all. A number of young people came towards the library one day, and the library simply opened up its doors to them rather than resist. So you have a range between those, and it all depended on local customs and how that library was held in esteem by the local people.
Fascinating. Are there any other notable ways that library integration kind of differed from some of the other, like bus integration or lunch counter integration?
For the most part, students would go into the library and they'd simply sit down and read books until police were called and kicked them out for disorderly conduct or vagrancy or some other trumped up charge like that. They were called read-ins and they were called sit-ins. On occasion, the librarians in the building would lock the doors against the protesters when they saw them coming, and then you would have kneel-ins in the front of the library. So there were all sorts of responses to library segregation, and it was kind of spontaneous. What the kids did was what occasioned their response. In rural Louisiana, for example, there was one regional library system that had three branches, and the kids would approach each branch, and at one place they were locked out, at another place they were locked out, and at a third place they got in, and there they were arrested for vagrancy or disorderly conduct. I can't remember which.
That leads perfectly into the next thing I'm curious about. Now, a little bit of background. I've always been a library lover. I come from a library family. And I have always seen libraries as welcoming places. And before I started reading your book, before I encountered the information that you had in there, I kind of thought, well, you know, librarians, they were very welcoming and open, and they kind of helped grease the wheels here for this integration. But librarians didn't necessarily cover themselves in glory with this whole phenomenon, did they, when it comes to the integration?
That's correct. But even here, one must always be careful about stereotyping, because they range from a reference librarian in Montgomery, Alabama, who wrote a letter to the local editor of the newspaper about the treatment black people were receiving on the buses. This was during the Montgomery bus boycott, and she was literally railroaded out of town. Two, librarians who refused to communicate any information to the American Library Association about the protests which were going on. So you have a range, again, just like you have a range of protests, you have a range of receptions from the library. I'll give you one more example. The director of the Mississippi Library Commission received a letter from an African-American woman who wanted to start a library for her community in rural Mississippi. The director, because of constraints placed upon her, could not respond in an affirmative fashion to the African-American woman. She could respond saying, "I'm sorry, I can't help you." But at the same time, she then assumed an unofficial mantle, so to speak, and phoned the woman and said, "I'll help you in any unofficial way I can." So you can see the constraints of Jim Crow customs and laws imposed upon her official position. But as a human being, she wanted to help these people out to start a library.
Let's get a little bit more specific. We're here in Memphis, and in your section on Memphis, probably the most frequently mentioned name is Jesse Turner. He had a history with Jim Crow, not only growing up in Mississippi, but he attended college here in Memphis. So the day the whole incident really begins pretty early on, 1949, correct?
Mm-hmm.
He seems to casually suggest to his wife, "Why don't you go down to the public library?" It appears that he just didn't really think a whole lot of that. Didn't think that there would be a problem. Am I reading too much into your report?
It's hard for me to get into Jesse Turner's head. I can tell you, however, that he obtained a master's degree at the University of Chicago. So he and Allegra were in Chicago, where all libraries were open to African Americans, though indeed there were branches in the Chicago public library system that were located in black neighborhoods, which are patronized largely by black people. But I can see where he would have developed a familiarity with public libraries that suggested open access, and he had expectations of the same thing happening. It'd be hard for me to believe that he didn't know, however, that the public library was a segregated institution in the city of Memphis.
So, as far as your research informed you, was his Chicago experience pretty typical of libraries outside of the South, that for the most part they were integrated and pretty freely used by anyone who wanted to use them?
That is correct. It's pretty true. Now, in many northern communities, the branch libraries in the black neighborhoods had become community centers. We think in the 21st century, the library community kind of thinks that library as community center is a modern development. It's not. You can trace this concept all the way back to Louisville, Kentucky, where a son of former slaves, Thomas Fountain Blue, managed the two black branches in the Louisville public library system. And from the get-go, Thomas Fountain Blue said, we've got to make these things into community centers because in this segregated city, there are so few places where blacks are welcome and safe. That's what the community needs most. So those branch libraries developed a kind of a community concept that carried through to the present.
So it seems almost natural that Jesse Turner would make this quote-unquote mistake.
Yes.
Of sending his wife to the library thinking nothing of it.
Right.
Well, the landscape in Memphis, in the library system at that time, was the definition of separate but equal. They literally had separate libraries. Blacks could use some of the materials from the white libraries, but they had to request it and it had to be sent over. And what did you learn about that?
That's correct.
System?
Now, I'm going to take a little bit of an issue with your term separate but equal. They were separate, but they were not
True.
Equal. An awful lot of the materials that went from the main library to the black branches were discards. Books that the main library no longer wanted. And the contents of those books, of course, reinforced the very Jim Crow system that supported the main public library. So what was in the discarded materials
right.
wasn't too welcome either.
So a little later in the chapter, you quote Mr. Turner experiencing this insult to his wife, which is when she was, you know, refused service at the Cosset Library, asked to leave, and he saw that as an insult to his wife in 1949. As far as you know, is this the earliest attempt to integrate a Southern library? Was there one before?
As a matter of fact, Rosa Parks, who was secretary of the NAACP chapter in Montgomery, Alabama, the Montgomery chapter of the NAACP looked to integrate the Montgomery Public Library earlier than this. So, and there are many other instances. For example, Alexandria, Virginia, in 1939, five kids, teenagers again, walked into the segregated Alexandria Public Library, sat down, and were arrested for disorderly conduct. So the history of efforts to desegregate libraries is rather lengthy, but also rather unknown. I'll go back to that Alexandria, Virginia example. Though it made news in the local newspapers, the nation's library press entirely ignored it. They reported nothing about that Alexandria library protest, and this was 1939, 2 months after the association passed what was called the Library Bill of Rights, which supposedly promotes free access to all people, regardless of race, gender, ethnicity, etc.
And that's so fascinating because so often, you know, especially in popular culture, when you think of civil rights protests and the civil rights struggle, you think of the 1960s. And so to know as far back as 39 that this was beginning to gain some steam kind of casts these library protests and these library integration efforts. I mean, they were the leading edge, were they not?
Yes.
What kind of feedback have you received about that?
This is, I think, about the 18th presentation I've made here in Memphis about the book. And at a number of the sites, some of the former protesters who are still alive, after all, they were teenagers in the 1960s, they're now senior citizens, have showed up. And they're sharing their experiences. We deliberately reserve a certain amount of time for them to share their experiences about this. And so the stories, they've been buried for a long time. And the people who literally risked their lives to desegregate public libraries are now being heard for the first time. And that has been the most gratifying thing about this whole project. I'm loving it. Now, I mentioned that the American Library Association Press entirely ignored that Alexandria Public Library protest in 1939. In the works right now, the American Library Association has a resolution of apology, I'll call it. If they pass it this summer at the New Orleans conference, where we'll also have a presentation, and four protesters will be there to share their experiences in this program. If the American Library Association passes it, it is much like the House of Representatives and the Senate did in 2008, where they apologized for slavery and for enabling Jim Crow to exist.
So there's almost another entire book. It, just in the reactions that you've gotten from protesters.
Yes. It is my hope that we leave behind us a trail of inspiration to historians and local folks to go deeper into the desegregation of public libraries, because the stories haven't been told. I'll give you another example, if I may.
Yes.
I gave a talk in the District of Columbia Public Library, and a man named Ibrahim Muchman showed up. As Charlie Porter, he was a 15-year-old who protested in Columbus, Georgia, against the Columbus Public Library segregated library. He was down in Columbus about 4 years ago, and he went to the local public library to see what kind of record they had of the protest. And the librarian said, nothing like that happened here. So he got together with me. Cheryl and I do have 3 pages on the Columbus, Georgia Public Library desegregation, and we're now working on a program for Columbus, Georgia, in which the protesters still alive, one of them named Cleophas Tyson, who showed up at my Atlanta Public Library presentation, will be recognized for their contributions to the local community.
That is outstanding. But let's get back to the Memphis story just a little
sure.
bit. Sure. Got a few more things I want to dig into there. So as the Memphis establishment, the city, the library establishment, continued to fight Mr. Turner, he had brought suit. So as they fight his efforts to integrate, they frequently turn to laws. It seems to me kind of like a feeble effort to fight this. It was as if they were saying they were helpless to change laws, that the city officials were helpless to change laws. And they used terms such as the custom that prevails, or they leaned on the decisions of other city officials that were over them. I kind of got the sense that they felt like maybe they were fighting a losing battle and they didn't really have any better things other than to fall back on these laws.
You're correct. And actually, there aren't many laws that they could fall back on. Almost all the time, it was a set of customs. Memphis was not unlike many other major urban areas of the South. To challenge those customs was easier than challenging a set of laws. So that may be another reason why libraries integrated more rapidly than schools did, for example. Yeah, Jesse Turner recognized he was challenging a set of customs. Customs he had experienced in World War II as a vet, customs he had experienced as a kid in Mississippi, and customs he experienced on a day-to-day basis in Memphis, Tennessee.
I thought it was really interesting. On page 70, I don't think you named the attorney. I believe this is an attorney's statement, but it seems like the way you wrote that part of the chapter on Memphis, that this might just distill Mr. Turner's argument very eloquently, and it just seems like steadfastly this was the message throughout, and that is this. We decided that the request made by Mr. Turner can and ought to be granted without any difficulty at all. That was pretty much their message throughout, no matter what the city threw at them. And is that?
That is correct.
And so to steadfastly stand by something so simple and yet so powerful, I thought it was interesting, too, that they seemed to, in stages, be given little victories in Memphis. And at one point, they got integration into the libraries, but still had the absurdity of segregated bathrooms.
Yes. When Jesse Turner won his lawsuit and the library became integrated, the bathrooms didn't. And so Jesse turned right around and filed another suit.
Right. And again, there was no law per se.
Nope.
Just Jim Crow and customs.
That's right.
So again, it took too long, but eventually everything was integrated. Yeah.
Jesse was an early pioneer here. And efforts to desegregate the Memphis Public Library were accelerated by a number of events in the early 1960s, and most specifically those Greensboro, North Carolina lunch counter sit-ins. They juiced a whole generation of black kids into action. And so though Jesse was a pioneer in the 50s in attempts to desegregate the Memphis Public Library system, his efforts were accelerated by those events which occur outside the city of Memphis.
Do you think that's why it took him so long from the time of the original insult against his wife to the time he actually had his own first direct action? It's hard, nine years?
Yeah, it's hard. Yes, it was. It's hard for me to crawl inside his mind.
Right.
Why did he wait so long? Perhaps he was very strategic in his efforts and gestated this whole humiliation festered inside, and he looked for a time when it would most likely be successful. Perhaps that's what happened. Now, we had the Montgomery bus boycotts of 1955-56. We had Emmett Till's lynching in Mississippi in 56. We had the Central High School in Little Rock, Arkansas fiasco in 1957. So I'm sure he was reading the newspapers, watching the television set, and that may have factored into his thinking about the best time to file suit.
So it could be that early on, closer to the initial incident, he just decided to resign himself to just, wow, that's just the way things are around here. And then maybe eventually it just built up.
Let's play hypotheticals. I can't imagine that Allegra Turner had not been insulted by Jim Crow on numerous occasions in the 1950s, the Memphis Public Library being only one. And Jesse Turner thinking now, which institution, which public accommodation institution should I poke at first in an effort to desegregate? And maybe the two came together. The activities of the late 1950s, the humiliation Allegra suffered in 1949, and he said, let's try the library today.
And as you said, not being a compulsory institution, maybe it was a little less threatening a place to start.
Mm-hmm. I'd agree with that.
As far as the Memphis story in particular, did you find anything unique or anything that was done in a particularly different way than any of the other southern cities that you studied?
The difference would be timing is one. A lot of the activity that occurred in the 1960s in public libraries, as I said before, was by young people. Jesse was an adult in the 1950s, but he was a vet who had experienced humiliations of Jim Crow in World War II service. A lot of those vets came back after World War II and were angry about having to fight for democracy abroad and then being denied civil liberties at home, and they occupied the boards of Black Branch libraries and in several occasions encouraged young people to go ahead and protest at white libraries. So they were a group of people, and I see Jesse as fitting this kind of profile, who were fed up with civil rights violations, the Jim Crow system, and were willing to challenge it at several sites. So I think that's part of his profile. That's part of the difference. If you look at the post February 1960 activities here in Memphis, you'll see a whole lot more young people participating in public library protests. So that's the difference for Memphis. You've got that seasoned veteran filing suit in the city of Memphis and desegregating the public library after those Greensboro lunch counters sit-ins and supported by a whole bunch of young people. That would be the difference for Memphis.
So let's talk a little bit about, and this is all speculation, do you see any lessons through this research and through the integration? You know, today, present day, there's a lot of racial tension that has bubbled up again over the last couple of years. Of course, it's different in nature, but Do you feel like anything that was gained or anything that was learned about the struggles that you write about here, feel like there's anything that could be useful to America today as we try to sort through all these racial issues that are so talked about these days?
For Cheryl and me, the issue we see is burying some series of important events in history. Part of our job, we thought, was to certainly remind Southern historians and civil rights historians that here is a set of incidents that you all haven't covered in your literature and should be, because people risk their lives to accomplish this goal. But even broader, when Cheryl and I started writing this book, and we talk about it at social occasions, one member of the library community came up to us and said, "You mean libraries were segregated at one time?" And another member of the library community, when hearing that we were doing this book, said, "Well, why don't you come and lecture to my intellectual freedom class about the heroic efforts librarians made to open up access?" So both of these individuals had absorbed what we call the rhetoric of professionalism that librarians have sort of spun out. So a lesson we hope that emerges from the book is to remind them that this happened, and it needs to be part of our collective memory. So as libraries plot the future, they have it in mind. I'll give you one small example. In my latest ALA catalog of items to be purchased are a number of bookmarks, one of which is Rosa Parks. Now, when librarians without knowledge of these incidents looks at that Rosa Parks bookmark, they think, wow, this is kind of neat. We support Rosa Parks. But Cheryl and me, with this understanding of history, look at that bookmark and say, you know, she couldn't get into the Montgomery Public Library. So it changes our interpretation of the photograph and the saying on that bookmark. Same thing we could do for Martin Luther King, who read Gandhi as a 10-year-old kid in the segregated Sweet Auburn branch of the Atlanta Public Library. Couldn't get that stuff at the Atlanta Public Library Central Building.
We probably are all weary of the term fake news, but again, back to the Memphis story, they had their own set of fake news facts, if you will. The one in particular that struck me was with the segregated bathroom issue. They tried to say, well, there's a higher incidence of venereal disease among blacks, and therefore we have to have segregated bathrooms because it is a health issue. Venereal disease can be transmitted via a toilet seat, you know, on and on.
Fake news.
Fake news.
Yes. Many people who were supporting segregated facilities were seizing on anything that looked somewhat factual.
Grasping at straws.
Right.
So that is definitely one thing that we can take from the book as, you know, as we try to fight our own battles these days, is the importance of information, the importance of knowing history. Mm-hmm. So I think that's about all the time we have today. Thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Again, Mr. Wiegand has partnered with his wife, Shirley A. Wiegand, to complete the book, The Desegregation of Public Libraries in the Jim Crow South, which is published by Louisiana State University Press. I'm Blake McVeigh, and this is Book Talk.
Thank you for joining us today. Book Talk is produced in the studios of FM 89.3 WYPL Memphis, a service of the Memphis Public Library, a division of the City of Memphis. Book Talk is copyrighted by the Memphis Public Library, all rights reserved.